Please enjoy this ringback tone while your podcast is reached.
This is Raquel and Chelsea, and you're listening to Baroque Bitches. Welcome to Baroque Bitches, your art and art history gossip podcast. I'm Raquel.
I'm Chelsea.
All right, so let's get into it. So I'm excited.
I got all of my jewels on.
You got all dolled up. Thank you.
You can't even see my makeup, though. I had makeup.
Your makeup looks really good.
I feel like a fucking princess.
You got the glasses on. I got my fur hat on, which couldn't be compromised by the Zoom background. I didn't know that fur hats leak into a green screen.
It thinks it's a background. It's camo.
It thinks it's a background when honestly it should be at the forefront of everybody. I mean, look at this thing.
It's so good.
It's impeccable.
I mean, I feel like if I was in Ohio, I would definitely embrace winter like glam.
I know.
Like fur.
Yeah. You know what? Like
leather, everything.
My Nana used to just dress to the nines.
Not real fur. I don't know.
I mean, maybe it's vintage.
It's been long enough.
I know. You know what? It's already been made. It was my Nana's. I didn't have
That's
it made.
Allowed.
But like, she fucking had these made, dude. And
oh,
it's like,
what is it made out of?
Mink. And
oh,
rabbit.
That's
minks
supposed to be fancy,
are fucking
right?
Assholes, by the way. So like, fuck the minks. Thank you, Nana, for the coat. It's the coolest coat. Maybe I'll wear it next time. It's white and gray chevron.
Ooh,
on top of leather.
That's glam.
It's hella glam. But Nana was hella glam. She had like a beauty store. We could do a pod on Nana.
Dude,
for
my
sure.
Nana's kind of a brand tour too. Like, she lives at Nordstrom.
Well, my Nana didn't live at Nordstrom because Ohio, I don't think Ohio had Nordstrom. yeah. It's more like a go down to the
blouse
barn.
But they have
barn.
The best fucking antiquing and the best
There's
vintage.
Lots of vintage here. You can still go to a garage sale here and buy something for like a quarter. Yeah, no, it's great. And please don't come here and mark up my vintage. All of you stay where you are. But I've always dreamed of wearing the type of furs that the person we're going to talk about today definitely sported. And she would have them made, and then one of her husbands would take them and wear them as well, because he'd be so jealous that he needed to be the star. So there's lots of hot juices on this
seriously.
One today. And I'm excited to get into this one. I hope I do it justice.
And this one might be our first lady, I think.
Yeah, this is our first lady.
About time.
So, I mean, obviously the art world is very male dominated. So it's nice that we can already this early on incorporate a female.
Because we're the Baroque Bitches. Ooh, the
Baroque Bitches. I know. And, I was wondering, I don't think people think bitch is a bad word anymore, right?
I guess it's the context.
Well,
because I feel like, women can say bitch because we've probably been called a bitch by a man
before.
And
it's like taking back the negative connotation and be like,
yeah, it's definitely, we've heard, not like your gay guy friends that are like, oh my God, bitch. Like, that's totally fine.
Oh my God, bitch.
Like, that's allowed 100%.
Yeah, no.
More than anything.
Well,
but
anyways, this bitch, I don't think she would be appreciative of it, but listen, bitch, we're going to do it. Are we ready to visualize?
Yes, visualization.
All right, let's do it. Visualization station. All right, so visualize.
Visualize.
wake up. It's late morning. Or was it early afternoon? Ah, who cares? You stretch your arms up. Last night still whispering and weaving its way through your head. Did he stay the night again? Oh, wait. It was the new one. Is he still here? Oh, that's right. I told him to leave right after. Huh. You hear the click of tiny nails and feet pattering on a marbled floor nestled with chimes of dog tags rustling together. Oh, how comforting it is to feel endless fur babies nestled into your feet. You have an undying love for Lop Su terriers and Shih Tzus, though you never really could tell the difference. They're more loving than any human has been, I suppose. You look up, resting your cheek on the comfort of accomplishment that hangs on your wall above your head, in the form of a silver, sparkling, dazzling headboard. Oh, Alexander Calder, I finally broke you down and convinced you to make it. Isn't it a triumph, the way it glistens against these turquoise walls? Then there's my Modrian. Did we kiss once? Oh, who knows? Was he in love with me? Yeah, probably. They all were. Or weren't they? It's all a blur now, really. On my best days, the whole world loved me, and on my worst days, I was never beautiful enough, and they were really also very ungrateful. And yet, I remember every second vividly. Every fleeting kiss from men I loved with all my soul, and many remaining attached for far too long. The kinds you want to go away, but men can be so disposable, can't they? That is until you don't want them to be. But the truth is, I've never loved anything as much as these. My paintings, my sculptures, these works all around me, these are my babies, my greatest accomplishments, and I love them perhaps more than I've ever loved anyone or anything, or maybe not. Either way, it's done. They're here. So come one, come all for this exciting episode I like to call Peggy Guggenheim and the Removable Penis.
The penis. Awesome. Hi. Oh my gosh. Yeah. She is the prototype. Dude. She's the one. Made Calder get something sparkly.
Dude. And something made of silver, nonetheless, which was so not his jam. No. So there is a lot to say today and a lot of accomplishment here. I've been mystified by this woman for a long time. So we're talking about Peggy Guggenheim, and she was an American art collector born into a fancy ass family. Basically made herself a badass Baroque bitch when it came to the modern art world. So
why not?
Yeah, why not? So a little backstory on why I wanted to do this. I remember sitting in modern art class with Professor Schwager. I doubt you're listening. You are the coolest person, my favorite art history teacher by far. I used to call him Professor Swag Daddy behind his back.
I feel like I learned so much from him. I don't remember, anybody
the
else.
Other faces and like light art history, but he
made it accessible.
He made it accessible,
which is kind of what we're trying to do.
Humanize these people. And he told a story about Peggy Guggenheim when we were learning about Jackson Pollock, and pretty soon, guys, you'll know why if you don't already. I'll never forget him saying like that she owned in her collection a Marino Marini piece called Rider in Ecstasy, and it's a bronze statue of a guy like arms and legs spread out riding a horse, and he has a fully erect penis. And Professor Schwager said, you know, rumor has it, the penis was removable so that Peggy Guggenheim could use it to, you know. So that's the rumor. And we'll get there at the very end. But that's why I so wanted to do this episode, because it's probably the first art history lesson where the rumors really drove my intrigue. Like, who the fuck is this bitch in the fucking 40s like dominating the art world, and then having artists making her a fucking bronze dildo?
Amazing.
She, it, like, just is a world of her own. Words like visionary, legendary, love it. Like, get associated with her, as well as like some bad words. Like probably in my head was ringing like terrible mother, maybe unhuman like. But you know, nevertheless, she changed the art world, and it's really forever indebted to her in a lot of ways. And so, let's get into the context.
Context.
So she's born 1898 in New York City. Think like There Will Be Blood times, or like a little bit before, but like Gangs of New York times, where it's like, you know, immense fucking wealth meets like really fucking poor. And she's definitely part of the immense wealth. The very big year for New York when she's born. The five boroughs that we know today all are joined together to make up New York. And it's just the center of industry, bustling, the landscape that we know it. Yeah, the New York we know today had all been only built like just of 10 years earlier. The Met, Washington Square Arch, Carnegie Hall, New York Public Library, all that's recently built. And Ellis Island and U.S. Immigration Inspection begins operating. So you can think, like, when she's born, it's still a big city, but it's about to become a huge fucking city, right? And so art context, we have Art Nouveau and Impressionism and Post-Impressionism kind of happening. And this is really before her, like, you know, adolescent years and coming 2 years in the art world. But that's where we're coming off of. So her family immigrated into America before this. Her grandfathers both immigrate in like the mid-1800s. Her maternal grandfather, Seligman, and paternal Guggenheim, obviously, because that's her last name. The Guggenheims make their...
The first Googs,
and I call them Googs a lot because Guggenheim is a mouthful. Yeah, and the Sellies instead of Seligman. So the way she describes her family, I wouldn't have gone back this far, but her family, they just sound like a Roald Dahl book mixed with like Lemony Snicket. Like, it's like so many interesting characters. So I thought it was fun to include because it's kind of like rumory. So her grandfather, Seligman, was apparently very scrappy. Some would say stingy, but I like scrappy because I like to think I'm scrappy. And he's her grandma that he's married to. She used to walk into shop owners and apparently go up to them and say things like, "Do you know when the last time my husband slept with me was?"
Oh.
And this is like in the 1800s.
Yes.
I think that would still be a little unsettling today if somebody walked in and was like, "Do you know when the last time my husband slept with me?"
I'd be like, okay.
I mean, girl, I'm here to listen, but I don't know. Like, I don't know you. So you can only imagine how peculiar that would have been at that time. Her favorite aunt, she calls an incurable soprano. And apparently she used to, like, go on street corners and just practice her scales, like, la, 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 la.
Okay, and showman. She would be
wearing, like, and she'd be wearing, like, a feather boa with crazy hair.
This bit.
And a hat, probably a lot more.
Oh, I'm living.
Right? I'm here for it. And, you know, she loves this aunt. She has very fond memories of her making a beautiful tomato jelly. Her husband didn't feel the same way as he beat her with a golf club and tried to murder her and her son. And then afterwards, when he doesn't succeed, he goes to a nearby river, ties weights to his feet, and drowns himself.
Okay, we got some rage. We got some trauma responses.
Yeah, we got some trauma responses. And this is said in the autobiography in this very just like,
it is, you know, what it is.
It is what it is.
He beat me with a golf club.
Another uncle was a super fancy, always dressed to the nines, apparently super duper hottie body. And when he separates from his wife, he decides to go into this very small apartment and buy nothing but fur coats.
Wow.
I think it's funny. He like, just fills his apartment with fur coats, which he, of course, gives to the ladies. But
we love a generous uncle.
Another uncle lives on eating charcoal, drinking whiskey for breakfast, keeping ice in his pockets to chew on, and never eats anything.
All right.
And he loves to gamble and would threaten to kill himself whenever he would run out of money.
Oh.
And then he, like, had a mistress that he quote unquote kept in his apartment.
Oh, no.
Wouldn't let anybody see her. And
I know
it gets worse. So then he succeeds in killing himself. And then his dad shows up to the funeral with the mistress on his arm.
Oh, like, wow.
Yeah.
To the funeral. Yeah. That's bold. That's like bold. Kind of brutal too. I don't know. I mean, drama.
It's not nice.
Like, that's definitely the most gossipy funeral probably.
I mean, and just acts like it's nothing. So then on the Guggenheim side, she casually says, like, oh, Grandpa Googs was married to his stepsister.
Okay.
And apparently this side of the family is, like, normal, quote unquote, by way of comparison. So she has two sisters. Mm. They live in the Upper East Side. And she says, and I have not a single happy memory of my childhood. No friends. She wasn't allowed to go to school until she was 15. She's just, like, very isolated in this world.
Oh. Now, was the Upper East Side during this time kind of how we imagine it?
Oh, yeah.
Of totally. What it is today, of the fancy, the elite, the kind of not really being able to see what's really around them.
Yeah, no, and it rings true.
Oblivious.
Throughout the, like, her whole understanding of herself and her situation. But there's this very, like, poor me mentality for a lot of her life. And, you know, it's all relative to what you're going through, right? Mm-hmm. Like, everybody's problems are the biggest to themselves. But at the same time, you kind of, like, need to take notice of the people around you. So we'll dive a little bit deeper,
like,
into that.
Read the room before your
read
millionaire
the fucking
ass
room, right?
Starts complaining.
yeah, absolutely. So then she has this accident and riding a horse in Central Park, breaks her jaw in multiple places, and her front tooth falls out, and she says this is, like, the death of any luck of beauty that she would have ever had. So Pegs is not known to be a great beauty, and she kind of, like, blames it on this accident. Mm. The worst part is she says she doesn't remember her mom being there whatsoever during her recovery from this, which is, like, super fucked. I just can't imagine. Her mom comes with these eccentricities from her Sally side of the family. Mm-hmm. It sounds like she has, like, OCD. She does things like wear three watches and does everything in threes, kind of like Jack Nicholson and As Good As It Gets. Like, mm-hmm. she's just, like, you know, washing her hands in threes and knocking on things three times and just being,
that,
like, very,
that sounds pretty,
you know,
OCD. Yeah.
Difficult to live with that.
Yeah.
At a time where I'm sure it would, nobody was trying to, like, understand her.
Totally. They'd be like, you're just fucking nuts. All right, I guess.
Yeah. And so then her dad, like, has also some physical ailments, quote unquote, that he, like, hires this nurse for. Mm-hmm. It starts this just, like, series of affairs, and he's never really around.
Oh.
Except there's also kind of, like, it seems like a child's perspective of what's happening, because in the same, like, after one sentence that she says, my dad leaves and he's, like, rid of us, she also says that they spend summers together in Europe and he makes sure that she's well-educated in the arts and that they are exposed to all this different art history and churches and things like that. So it's definitely, like, that kind of child understanding of, like, you were never there.
Mm-hmm.
But it sounds like he was.
He was in his own way.
It's not a typical ideal home life, for sure. I mean, mommy's out there counting things in threes. Daddy's fucking the nurse. Like, it's not what you want.
Yeah.
And I'll give her that. So things, like, they're not so bad, right? Mm. Well, then her father gets a ticket to go back to America. and he books a ticket on the Titanic.
No.
Yeah. So I
the
know.
Titanic. Yeah. Oh my God. Don't get me started again in that fucking hole. I pretty much went down with that whole submarine situation. I went down the hole for like a few weeks of like, listen, wait, people are interested in the Titanic and they're trying to get down there and oh my God, it imploded. Oh my God, did they know? Did they know that they were going to implode?
Like, listen, the whole world literally dropped everything to look for those.
To look.
Like maybe they're coming back. God, like, there was some idealism so in there. Like maybe they're coming back.
Yeah, they have enough oxygen. Like, girl. No, that ship was not good. Didn't pass any inspections. And y'all were risking
Why?
It.
Why? James Cameron like... gave us enough. But so you remember the movie, though.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God.
And the scene where like that rich ass dude is like, tonight we'll go down as gentlemen.
Oh, yeah.
When they're like, so your life jacket. And he's like, tonight we go down as gentlemen. But I would like a brandy. That's daddy.
Damn. Going down with the ship.
So, Benji Guggenheim. Mm. Yeah, that's him. So he dies. Yeah. If I didn't. Spoiler alert. But not, and you know what fucking sucks is like his mistress was on the Titanic with him and she's the one that delivers the news back that like, no, he voluntarily like died because he wanted there to be enough room on the lifeboats when he like knew there wasn't.
It was
and
like, let
and
the women and children go. I'm a
hero.
Yeah,
let them go.
I will die.
Yeah, and he apparently just like sat on the deck drinking brandy and smoking cigars until his death. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's like a nice story, but then like the fact that it was delivered by the mistress is like, dude,
yeah,
that sucks.
Not the coolest. So the mistress was on the Titanic, but she survived. She went into this lifeboat.
Yeah, so she survives. Okay. She survives into one of the lifeboats. So he dies and, you know, leaves Peggy $450,000. Mm. And she acts like this is like not a lot of money, okay? But I valued it like what is it worth now? And that would have been $42 million by today's standards. So, yeah. And that's what I mean when I'm like the poor me card gets pulled out
a
lot.
You got 40 million. You can never be sad.
And she's still, well, right? And she still does this whole like, and you know, I'm the poor Guggenheim because her dad right before, like a few years before he dies, sells his shares to the Guggenheim business and he's like, no, I'm going to start my own thing. And doesn't obviously live long enough to like fully develop that and bring it to fruition. So when he dies, he leaves them with like a significantly less money than what they have. And ever after that, she feels like she's like not good enough to be a Guggenheim.
Okay.
And I don't think it helps that like her uncles don't tell her mom like what's going on with the finances until and let her keep living in this like fancy ass apartment in the Upper East Side with servants and like everything like you could imagine they have, you know. And but then she says like, so then when we find out, we move to a much smaller apartment with less servants. Oh, you're like, okay, listen, Boogs, listen, Pegs.
Must be so hard.
Nobody fucking has servants.
Oh my gosh.
So she spends her teenage years doing what any teenager would do and just is like being a fuckhead, kissing boys and working at like a World War One uniform depot, helping soldiers get fitted and like having like little, you know, quick engagements to them before they like go off. And
yes.
She's not fucking them though.
Okay. Tease.
And then she starts working in this radical bookshop in New York. And her mom fucking hates all of this. Like, she's like, no, you're an heiress. Like, you're supposed to be, like, doing heiress things, like a debutante ball and being prim and proper.
Yeah. And just being polite and pretty.
Yeah, just sit there, be pretty, you know. And
Be nice.
And so it's very clear at a young age that she wants to set herself apart. And when she's working at this bookshop, there's a lot of celebrities that come in. And one is her soon-to-be husband, Dadaist writer Lawrence Vail.
Oh.
Yeah, so Lawrence Vail is known as, like, the king of Bohemia. I mean, the it guy. She, like, thinks he's super hot. He's a writer, painter, sculptor. Look up Lawrence Vail's bottles, and you will get an idea for what this guy's about. So a little bit on Dada. I love this art movement. I always have. I think it's so fucking cool. It's like an anti-war crew, think fed up with the government, fed up with politics. And there's this, like, idea that society is trying to be based off of logic and nationalism and reason that leads to war and destruction. So how do you combat logic and reason? With, like, absurdity, right? Like, anti-logic. Like, and so, you know, before this, with Impressionists, they already kind of start this idea of art being philosophical, you know, like strokes can just be representational, and it can, and it's moving in this direction. But Dada makes it a little bit more extreme, like, like, you know, it challenges you to think, like, can anything be art? You know, and if, and can anything be art? Hans Richter calls it, like, anti-art. You know, like,
put that banana and tape it to the wall.
Flip that urinal on its side. It's a fountain. Yeah, it's a art. Fountain.
Like, no, it's not.
Fucking
it
art.
Is because I said so.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Because I said so. And so he's like, Lawrence Vail is, like, all about it. And so she hooks up with him and the Fleischmanns. And this crew, like, starts it all for her. And likely introduces her to, like, all of her connections that she's that starts her off in this art world. So the Fleischmanns introduce her to Alfred Steigskull, an early promoter of modern art, and he puts her first modern art painting into her hands. She said she had to turn it around 4 times to figure out how she wanted to look at it, and it was by Georgia O'Keeffe. Yeah, so that's, like, her first little art love story. So after this, she moves to Europe. She marries Lawrence Vail, and they have 2 children, Pagin and Sinbad. Oh. And tell me, Pagin, that's not, like...
I like both of that.
They're cool names. But Sinbad, like, being a 90s kid, you can't help
Immediately. You know, immediately. I go to Sinbad. Immediately.
So Lawrence Vail and her have, like, a crazy fucking marriage and romance. And it sounds horrible. Like, she says things like, he's, like, holding my head under bathtub water but she'll be like, but it wasn't so bad. Like, he's, like, just beating the shit out of her. They're getting fucking wasted all the time. This is, like, the era of, like, lunchtime cocktails, you know? And
let's bring it back. I mean, I still sometimes
but let's also leave this part of it at home, because it's very
not
much
the
like
head underwater.
Not the head underwater, like, but I would like a French 75 at lunch.
Yes.
Sometimes. Not all the time, but from time to time.
Yeah.
This is, like, an all the time thing.
Okay.
So she's having this crazy marriage with him. It doesn't work out. She starts a love affair with John Holmes, and they decide it's a good idea to split their kids.
Oh.
So, like, I'll take Pagin and you take Sinbad.
Okay.
So
yeah.
That's going to feed into some rumors later. So then she moves to London and decides this is where she wants to start a little gallery. She's not collecting yet, but she wants to start a little gallery called Guggenheim June. And it's like a rich girl passion project.
For sure. Let me just open a gallery. Let me just
open a gallery.
I'll put, like, $1 million in it. It's fine. It's fine. if it fails, this is $1 million.
And let me tell you, she acts like it is, like, draining so much money. But then she also says it's, like, $600 a year or something. And it's like, bitch, I know that you have, like, a fuck ton of money, okay? Like, you can't. Anyway, so she's, like, really good friends with Marcel Duchamp, and she links up with him and this other guy Putzel, and they teach her everything she needs to know. So they teach her the difference between, like, surrealism, cubism, Dadaism, all the different things. They're very much educating her and advising her on who to show in her gallery.
And what movement is the next big thing?
What movement? Well, so there's... So we'll get some arty terms in here. So avant-garde, okay. It's very much the time of avant-garde. And I'm sure you've heard that used like colloquially, like some diphead in fucking college. Being like, oh, avant-garde.
It's really like, avant-garde, yes.
And yeah, So so avant-garde is just like unusual experimental ideas, especially in art. And that translates into pretty much every art movement that's happening at the time. There's surrealism, which everybody, for the most part, knows Dali. If you don't, Dali. Like, don't feel bad, okay? Just Google it. Like, Dali. Like, it's some, if you like art, artist. you should fucking know who he is, maybe. But, like, don't feel bad if you don't. Like, I don't want anybody feeling bad. Look up the persistence of memory. That's the melting clock one.
Y'all know the clocks.
Yeah. The melting clock. So, but in surrealism, there's definitely an idea of reality, right? Mm. It's objective. There's magic and strangeness. It looks like a dream. And then there's kinetic art, which is just art that moves or that has like perceived motion. And then there's cubism, which is like, you know, Picasso.
Yes. Different there's, perspectives on the same plane.
Yeah, on the same plane. Ooh. Hella geometric shapes, geometric. Mostly monochromatic.
Geometric.
Picture plane is like flat as a board. Mm-hmm. And so those are kind of like the movements that we're dealing with at this gallery. And Dadaism as well. So she, under the advisement of Marcel Duchamp, has Cocteau as her first exhibition there. And she coincidentally does his first solo exhibition ever. She does Kandinsky's first solo exhibition Ooh. Ever. And she brings the art to London. So this would have been his first, like, show in London. Mm. And there's, so I'm just gonna read this fucking name. This woman's fingers must have been on fire from how many names she could drop. Brancusi, Raymond Duchamp, Pevsner, Henri Lawrence, Alexander Calder, John Tunnard, Piet Mondrian, Yves Tanguy, Bronner, Dominguez, Andre Breton, Max Ernst, Leonora Carrington, Giacometti, Ferdinand Lager, Dali, John Jarnerp, Max Ernst, Pablo Picasso, Joan Moreau. And the list goes on and on. Those are just like the most famous, but
it's a lot of shapes.
There's many other. So many shapes happening. And so many personalities and so many just
big personalities.
Happening.
Egos. Fucking
There's
dicks.
Actually a story, like she goes in to try and buy a Pablo Picasso and he tells her, "Oh no, madam, the laundry's on the other floor. You're in the wrong place."
Ooh,
fucker, right?
Asshole, dude.
But so one thing she does while she's here, she's trying to put together this sculpture show, and London at the time has this like weird tax situation where like if it's not considered art, then it has to be taxed for the material type, which makes it fucking super expensive and difficult to showcase art from anywhere else in London. Mm-hmm. And so the Tate Gallery director is the one who has to decide if it's art or not. And he decides that her show with all these famous, they're now famous, but at the time they weren't. And he decides like, no, it's not art. And she takes it to the House of Commons and gets that changed.
Damn.
So she is the reason that people
changed art.
She changed art.
Yes.
And she really globalizes art. Like she's part of this. Mm. So she takes this and gets it approved. And now abstract art, whether or not people want to like it or not, because at the time they very much did not like it, can be like brought in.
Sorry, you don't get it.
So I like the story of Kandinsky here. When she meets Kandinsky under the recommendation of Marcel Duchamp, she gives him the solo show, which he had never had in London. And Kandinsky's like
the guy that makes paintings, but like if you can imagine what jazz looks like
on a canvas,
that's Kandinsky.
Like, yeah, like yeah. It's just like it's they it's just stuff thrown on a canvas. It looks jazzy as fuck. That's the perfect way to describe it. Yeah,
shapes.
Shapes. And lines.
And lines.
And it's circles sometimes.
Yeah.
Well, he's considered the father of abstract expressionism. And he's influenced by, like, a lot of impressionists and the idea of, like, art for art's sake. And he runs with that. Nice. So she isn't the only Guggenheim that likes art. Her uncle Solomon's also collecting. But he has, like, a curator for his museum, Baroness Rebet. Oh. And so Kandinsky tells Peggy, like, I tried to get your uncle to, like, buy one of my paintings. And he said no. Like, do you think you could, you know, hook it up, like, get him to buy one? Mm-hmm. And so she reaches out to her uncle, and he passes her on to this Baroness. And the letter that she gets back is fucking brutal. It says, Dear Mrs. Guggenheim June, your request to sell us a Kandinsky picture was given to me to answer. Your gallery will be the last one for our foundation to use. If ever the need to get historically important pictures should force us to use a sales gallery, it is extremely distasteful at this moment when the name of Guggenheim stands for an ideal in art to see it used for commerce, as if this great philanthropic work was intended to be a useful boost to some small shop. You will soon find out you are propagating mediocrity, if not trash. If you are interested in non-objective art, you can well afford to buy it and start a collection. This way, you can get into useful contacts with artists, and you can leave a fine collection in your country if you know how to choose. If you don't, you will soon find yourself in trouble. Due to the foresight of an important man since many years collecting and protecting real art through my work and experience, the name of Guggenheim became known for great art, and it is very poor taste indeed to make use of it, to our work and fame, to cheapen it, to a profit. Yours very truly, H.R. P.S. Now our newest publication will not be sent to England for some time to come. Okay, let's just say it. Bitch!
Fucking cunt. Fucking energy. Bitch,
right? Like,
not
dude.
In a good way.
Like, okay, never mind. Yeah, like, Jesus. Sorry. So.
Just say no. I know.
Just
like,
say
we
no.
could say no and leave it
you
at that.
You don't have to be a dick.
No,
like,
see you at Christmas or Hanukkah. Bye.
Bye, yeah, Hanukkah. Right.
Love you.
I love you. Bye.
Like, small dick energy.
Dude, just such a fucking bitchy. So
no.
Anyway, they don't buy a Kandinsky painting, by the by. So after this, after about a year of doing it, she was, you know, with that John Holmes guy, and then he dies in an operation. She starts fucking his best friend, Samuel Beckett. And so she's like going off to Paris to like fuck this dude, probably neglecting her children a lot.
Oh, yeah, the kids.
And she, the kids. And she just doesn't have time for her rich girl passion project. So she closes Guggenheim June. And afterwards, there's like pickup of the war, World War II, is going to happen.
Oh,
so, yeah. So she starts buying a painting a day.
Oh.
That's like her goal, a painting a day. Under the advisement of Marcel Duchamp and others. So she's like feverishly just buying paintings to the point where people are like bringing paintings to her bedroom for her to look at and buy.
Must be nice.
Buys a shit. Right. And everything she pretty much buys is in Hitler's degenerate show. You know, that like art show he puts on of like, you should hate this. Like, pretty much everything she likes is in that show, like all the artists. And then she has to get out, the war is picking up more and more, even though she moves to South France, like, she's still like, I gotta get the fuck out of here, I'm Jewish, dude, I gotta leave. But yeah, there's still this air of, like, I'm untouchable, and I don't really know what's going on, maybe.
Like, but like, I have a fuck ton of money, so what would really
happen? Doesn't really seem that serious to her, like, it's, like, more just, like, oh, and then on top of it, she has artist friends, like, reaching out to her, like, can you help me get to America? And she does take a few with them, but it doesn't sound like it's like that as many as it maybe could have been. I don't know. But either way, so she meets
Max. She didn't know the real scope of what was happening.
Right. And she, I mean, you know, she's just out of touch. Mm. Anyway, she meets Max Ernst and they go to New York. And this is where abstract expressionism really gets born. She's called the midwife of abstract expressionism for her work
birth at the gallery. Into New York.
She, well, so she like has all these, you know, European artist friends, and then she's, you know, gets to America and it's like, I want to meet all the American mm-hmm. people. Like, I want to, you know, and I also, like, want to keep going with this momentum. I think that letter, it's interesting because it does seem like it has this implication of, like, if you want to do this, like, collect mm-hmm. art, you know, like, make something of it. And maybe she took that a little seriously. Like, maybe I should start collecting art. And so... Anyway, she definitely wants to, like, insert herself into this movement in a way that's more meaningful. It seems like she goes from Guggenheim June, this, like, cutesy little, you know,
just, project. Yeah, a little gallery.
I want to get more serious. I want a museum, and I want people to take me seriously.
I want a museum. Like, I'm not an
Daddy. But it's also like, and it also has this vibe of like, I have all these artists that are my qualifiers, like they like me, but why am I here? What's my purpose? Like, how do I fit in here? And it's like, oh, well, I have a shit ton of money. I fit in because I can fund it all. So it just seems like very early on, there's this dynamic of like, I fucking love art and I want it to love me back. And she does that by like, I could imagine how difficult it is to be so sought after for your money, right?
Yeah.
Like, especially once she starts buying all the time and people are coming to her doorstep and coming to her bedroom. And I would imagine it'd be really difficult to discern like who likes you and who doesn't.
Yeah. That reminds me of Louis.
So Max Ernst, that relationship is very much like that similar vibe. She never thinks that he's in love with her. He definitely does the will they won't they with her, and so did Lawrence Vale, like definitely strings her back and forth, and she's madly in love with both of them, and she thinks Max Ernst is like super fucking hot, even though he wasn't in my opinion, but apparently he was just like a character. He was just like looked like a character out of a book. He wears her clothes, they collect weird relics together, like a beautiful totem pole and masks. And it sounds like their apartment just have been like honestly, I'm getting like a little bit of like autism vibes, and I say this like, you know, because I'm autistic, my son's autistic, and I just feel like she like hyper fixated on art a little bit.
Yeah.
And gets like her like other neurodivergent friends to also hyper fixate on art a little bit.
Yeah, and like strange things and putting strange things around your house and on the walls and things like that.
Yeah, there's definitely some neurodivergence happening with her like kind of collection. Disconnect from her daughter,
yeah,
from her son, like, oh, just split them up, you know. No biggie. So so anyways, with Max Ernst, they do their neurodivergent dive together. She has all these fur coats made, and you know, she's always tailored up to the nines. She looks super dope. And he loves to wear her clothes, and you know, they're just this fun, like weird avant-garde couple.
They are.
So she opens Art in the Century, and it's coolest art gallery I think that could have ever come out of its time. It's in 1942, and there's four different galleries inside of it, each having a representation of different art movements. So there's like surrealism in one room, cubism in another. She has them all there, housed in the same spot. Awesome. And then from her uncle, she hears of a carpenter that's working there, Jackson Pollock. And Marcel Duchamp is like, dude, you gotta see this guy. Like, he's amazing. Yeah, splattery paint. You know, there's so many people, again, and I'll get more deeply into Jackson Pollock, but so many people come out of this gallery. Mark Rothko, Willem de Kooning, Baziotz, Hans Hoffman, Clifford Still, David Hare, Adolf Gottlieb, Hedda Stern, Ad Reinhardt, Chirico, Arp, Giacometti, Hillion, Hans Richter, Hirschfeld, von Duisberg, Peguin, Lawrence Vale, Rice Pereira, the list goes on and on and on and on and on. So, and well, because she makes this gallery, she houses all of these people together, and it just has this like perfect birthplace for this new,
kind of like the Renaissance.
Kind of. It's like all the, you know, Europe's coming with America. They're all together. They're all merging and influencing the hell out of each other. And I think, you know, it's the perfect atmosphere for that new type of painting to be born, that physical art that Jackson Pollock's so well known for. So, you know, those are her biggest accomplishments, and they're huge. And that's very, like, brief overview of them, but I want to get into the fucking rumors before this episode ends, so let's go. Okay, all that shit's like why fucking? You should care, and now let's really get into it. So lover list. So she has said herself that she's had over 1,000 lovers, which is, wow. Yeah, so if you average out 1,000,
we got bodies.
If you average out 1,000 lovers, like let's say you're having sex for 5 minutes, that's almost a full fucking week of having sex. And that's just if one time. So, yeah. That's a lot.
She got WAP.
She got a WAP. WAP. So with Samuel Beckett, one of the guys she has an affair with, her lover after John Holmes, she says they went to bed and didn't leave for 4 days except to get sandwiches from room service. She slept with a shit ton of these artists, Tanguy, Modrian, Brancusi. She says with Brancusi, she thought it would make Bird in Space cheaper, but it didn't. And she says, like, when she leaves with it, that he's crying and she can't tell if it's because of the sculpture or because of her leaving. There's very much this like consistent, you know, she's trying to create this lore around herself as being like this very sexual being. She's not hiding it.
Okay. Yeah.
And she's not hiding it at a time when like her family probably wanted her to hide that.
Well, I think too, it's like a part of the avant-garde too of I want to be different. We all fuck. Why don't we just start being open about it and not giving a shit about it?
Well, and I think, like, I do think that there's some, you know, I want to be remembered for being a trailblazer of, like, this whole thing.
I'm the most different bitch.
I'm the
right
most
now.
Different, and I'm going to do whatever the fuck I want.
Icon moment.
And it's kind of, it's like, dude, Peggy, like, I love this for you. I love that you're just, like, fucking indisposing. Like, do that all day. Like, you know, like, reverse that dynamic. Take back that masculine power. There's also this, like, it's underscored by, like, her being incredibly insecure. Oh. Whenever she talks about somebody that she's married or she's in love with, or she'll say, like, I think he was in love with me. But then a little later she'll say, you know, he never loved
me.
So there's this back and forth, which I think is really normal for all.
I mean, if you're fucking for 4 hours, he loves you.
Or he loves that pussy. But yeah. Like, it's this constant back and forth of, like, I am the shit. No, I'm not. I'm amazing. Everybody loves me. Nobody does. And you can tell it's kind of a...
It's a very polarizing attitude about it.
Yeah, and the way that she talks about, like, in her book, talks about sex, it's not at all, like...
Like, did she even really like having sex with all these guys?
I think she did. I think what is true is that she's so in love with all this art, and she associates the maker of the art with that. And so it's like she's getting as close as she possibly can to this art by having intimate relationships with the people creating them.
She puts them on a pedestal, like literally puts them on a pedestal.
Puts them on a pedestal.
Yeah.
And then puts them on the wall. But artists are fucking assholes. Like musicians are assholes. Mm-hmm. Artists are, you know, super full of themselves, especially at this time.
I always recommend any of my students be like, don't date another artist or musician or actor.
Get you someone, need somebody simple, to
get
to
a plumber or an IT guy or something. The guy that works at the grocery store, get him.
It's
he's
just not, like
he's grounded,
right? Like a lot of artists, like and like are floating, and they need to be tied down. Like,
yeah,
like with, you're gonna fly
with
away.
A rational man or woman or whatever. Like,
right,
get into somebody that just has a normal job. And right. doesn't really get what you're doing, but loves you anyway.
Right? Exactly. And when you, not bring it out, artist. You bring out that painting, they go, that is fucking amazing. What is it?
I love it. It's great. I don't get it, but I love it.
I don't get it, but I love it.
That's what you
so
need.
So anyway, yeah. Marino Marini, so writer in Ecstasy, that rumor that we talked about at the beginning. So she goes to borrow a sculpture from him for a show and ends up buying one. And it's a horse riding, you know, like we talked about.
And fully.
It's a funny sculpture. God. It'll make you giggle if you look it up.
It's so, they're both so derpy, though. Like, they're just a
derp. I know. So he, like, she goes to borrow one and he makes it. And he makes it with a removable penis. And she maintains in this documentary that he only makes it removable because at the time she's living in Venice and he wants her to be able to remove it when, like, the nuns come over
yeah.
or, like, if they're passing by. But then she also kind of, like, cheekily says, like, you know, the legend in Venice is that I have several removable sizes and that,
that's pretty
you know,
good.
I do whatever I want with them. But, like, I can't imagine, like, masturbating with a bronze dick sounds
no,
all that fun. Like,
that
it's got to be heavy and cold and, like,
I don't know, rusty.
But, you know, who knows? Maybe Pegs was into pegging. Maybe it was used for other things.
It was involved.
So then Pegeen. So Pegeen's her daughter. And in the documentary movie Art Addict, she speaks about Pegeen. Her daughter was also an artist, and you can look up Pegeen Guggenheim and see her work, too. She was very depressive, probably took after, like, the Seligman side. It sounds like Peggy has a weird relationship with her. In the documentary, she says, like, oh, we were kind of, like, lovers. Like, they were, and it was, like, I thought that was such a weird thing to say about your daughter. She says they're constantly fighting. She could never figure Pegeen out, and that Pegeen, what, like, the, I, and I'm like thinking in my head, well, you fucking, like,
I would,
left her, I'm sure, all just, the time. You don't sound like you were ever really emotionally available, and you sound like you were kind of, like, just not there in general, and you were like, oh yeah, but my art, like, I gotta go do the art thing, like, sorry, you want me to play with you, like, oh, that's cute, bye.
She's gonna be a little resentful of that.
So, and just, like, you know, not 100 with the mental health stuff. So Pegeen has a long history of attempted suicides. There's, like, an overarching theme of her wanting to be loved by her mom, and it definitely doesn't seem like she is. I mean, she is not mentioned once other than, like, oh, she was born in Peggy's book.
Wow.
So,
of, like, mom, I'm not even in your book, dude.
I'm not even in your book, but she does name one of her dogs after her.
Awesome. That's pretty shady.
That just sucks, dude. That sucks. So Ralph Rumney was an artist that Peggy goes to buy a painting from, and it didn't work out right away. And he then meets Pegeen, Peggy's daughter. And he says, I was hit by the most classic, unexpected form of love at first sight. It was quite obvious all the men were trying to pick up Pegeen. Since she looked fed up, I suggested to her rather abruptly that we get out of there. I took her by the hand. She came back to my place, and that's how it all started. Some dates later, her mother, still in the pursuit of my painting, returned to the fray. I told her I couldn't sell it to her as it now belonged to Pegeen. She snarled at her and said, you're fucking your way up to quite a collection.
Oh, I'm like,
not so nice. Not a nice thing to say to your daughter. So there's a party. Peggy used to throw parties at her house in Venice, and she would have all sorts of artist friends and, you know, come over. And Peggy storms in covered in blood and to one of these dinners with Ralph, and they're laughing about how Peggy tried to kill herself. And apparently, and Peggy talks about this as if it was like happening all the time. Like, it's just like, you know, oh, yeah, it's Tuesday. Like, here's Peggy, you know, covered in blood. No big deal. So eventually, Peggy does kill herself on a like barbiturate alcohol cocktail. And Peggy blames her husband and even goes as far as to like, get like lawyer up and like try and take him to trial for negligence of lack of care of like an insane person. Like, could you imagine like your wife dies and then your mother-in-law's like, I hate you so fucking much. Like, I'm going to take you for everything you're worth, which
especially
is nothing.
Like, you know, if somebody, if it's like, wow, that really wasn't expected. The husband's, that's the guy. You got to get him. But this was very much like she's been having several suicide attempts that we haven't really like stopped and kind of like gotten some help for.
Yeah.
We just kind of keep, do it this time. And then eventually, like, it's dangerous. Right. She's going to eventually hurt or kill herself. So, I mean, did you not see this happen in front of your eyes?
I mean, and it's definitely, like, in front of her eyes. And, you know, I don't know what I would do. I just know that I probably wouldn't take the husband to court afterwards. I mean, she gets his kids taken away. Like, she goes very far on this. And all of her grandkids who have come from Sinbad and Peggy, like, in their interviews, very much can support the fact that she's, like, not your typical grandma, you know, not getting the warm and fuzzies, not getting the cookies at Christmas, more just, like, the, you know, getting harsh criticism and, like, a cold shoulder sort of grandma. And so Jackson Pollock. So he's working for her uncle as a carpenter, and she gets a word from Marcel Duchamp, like, this guy's the shit, go for it. She offers him a contract, which is where you, like, pay the artist a monthly allowance, and she says she'll pay him $150 a monthly for 1 year and a settlement at the end of the year if he sells over a certain amount. So she says she dedicates herself entirely to selling his work. And Lee Krasner, his wife, helps her with this. Because Pollock, if you guys don't know, is like a raging alcoholic. Very difficult.
Super toxic to masculinity. Wrangle in. So hard.
Yeah, just, I mean, she says, to me, he was like a caged animal who should have never left Wyoming.
Yeah, that's a good description.
Which is probably true. So she commissions him to paint a painting for her entrance hall, 23 feet wide by 6 feet high. Yeah. Very on brand Pollock, but I don't think he's ever done anything this big before. It's now in the hands of the student dining hall at Iowa University, if you want to look it up. But so the story goes that he sits in front of it for days and months and doesn't know what to do. He even sends Lee away. He's like, get the fuck out. I can't focus with you around. And she comes back and nothing's happening and it's taking him forever. And then finally it hits him and he completes it within hours. And even Peggy mentions that in her book. And, you know, since then, scientists are like, no, we can see the paint dry. Like, it took him a while. But the first go at it might have been just, you know, within a day.
Yeah, and if you don't know his work, it's a lot of layers of paint. Yeah.
Lots of layers of paint.
Super thick.
Action painting is, action painting. Splattering, so it's like he uses his whole body. Yeah. The first time I saw one in person, I just cried. Like, it really made me tear up. They're guttural and breathtaking and
mesmerizing.
Sad.
Yeah.
Mesmerizing. So I like this story. So when they're trying to install it, It's giving them a shit ton of trouble because it's fucking huge. And Peggy, like, would hide bottles of alcohol when he would come around. Well, I guess he'd get so frustrated that he just goes looking and drinking all of them, becomes hysterical, and then walks naked into a party that her, like, roommate is throwing that she's living with at the time. There's another story. She throws him, like a you know, coming out party or whatever at the plaza, and he shows up fucking wasted and pukes everywhere. I just, like, I mean, as much as I, like, you know, he's kind of a shithead, I kind of admire his, like, lack of care for her a little bit, even though I know it's just, like, alcoholism. But at the same time, I like that she very much has an air of, like, at this point in her life of, like, you should fucking care about who I am. And he's like, I don't fucking give a shit. Like, you're a paycheck. You know, like, yeah, I'm going to get wasted.
Damn.
Thanks for the $150. Yeah. See you next month. So years later, when she's in Italy, she sees a Pollock exhibition and she says, I remember the extreme joy I had sitting in the Piazza San Marco beholding the Pollocks glowing through the open windows of the museum. It seemed to place Pollock historically where he belonged as one of the greatest painters of our time who had every right to be exhibited in this wonderful setting. So you can tell she considers him her greatest accomplishment ever. And, you know, it's clear why. I mean, she, in her gallery, is the only one who can sell his paintings. Nobody wants them. It's very difficult for her to, like, get him sold. And his reputation doesn't help. And so when it comes time for her to leave New York and close it down, she is trying to get him a contract with somebody else, and nobody will take him. And Betty Parsons, the only one that's like, I'll give him a show. I'll give him a show. That's all I can do. And it's unsuccessful. And, you know, ultimately, like, this, she feels, leads to his eventual demise. So those are the gossy gosses. After New York, she goes to Venice. This is, like, the place where she's always wanted to fucking live. And she moves into the Palazzo Venier de Leoni, which literally means, like, unfinished lion palace. It's the start of a palace. It's a single floor and it has like sculptures of lions. The previous owners apparently like owned because that's lions what you do. In their garden and shit. Because that's what you do. And she just fucking trailblazes modern art in Venice. She says before this, only Picasso and Klees were the only known modern artists. You got to remember, like, at this time, there's not a whole lot of, like, you can just, you can't just Google it, obviously. And you really can't, like, know what's going on abroad too intimately yet. There's travel back and forth, but it's not like it is now. This is still, like, the 40s. So, so this entire time that she moves back, she shows in the Biennale, which is, like, a huge art show every year. She's very much gets her collection known in Italy, gets it sent all over, borrowed, whatever. And, you know, people eventually obviously catch on to all these great artists that she has really found and housed in a collection. I think it's like 112 paintings, and she purchased for $40,000. And she, in the 76, she sold it back to the Guggenheim family for $76 million. But by today's standards, I mean, I read a Pollock single painting just sold for $120 million. Damn. This is a billion-dollar art collection. Billions. You know, she really impacted the art world in a way that, like, without her, I don't think would have happened as quickly.
She seems literally in love with the movement too. Like, she's in love with some of these objects.
She was in love with this art. Absolutely. She's intimately knowing these artists too, and pushes them to their limit. She has Alexander Calder make her bed frame, and he has silver that he makes it for her with.
And Calder is the guy that makes the mobiles.
Inventor of the mobile.
Shapes.
And he also does does, yeah, drawing, wire yeah. drawings he would do. And he's a sculptor. He's the shit. Fucking love him. Him and Frank Lloyd Wright seem almost like the antithesis to me in a lot of ways, because Calder liked to work with like meager materials that weren't very costly at all. So for him to
and
make
Frank
a
Lloyd Wright was he like big on like concrete and things like, I'm gonna make this out of fucking concrete. And you're like, okay, it's gonna look very industrial.
Yeah, I've always liked Alexander Calder. She like Tongi makes her earrings. Like, she has just all these very like invaluable memories,
but you,
that are,
but you gotta think too, it's
in
like
objects,
who's using who, especially that she's in relationships with these people, like sexual relationships with these people. And then
I think when you're that wealthy, there's just no way to get
of
around
like,
the
this
fact
guy
that,
has
like,
the work that I want and the talent, but are you really loving the guy or his talent? And then it's like, she's got all this money and influence. Do you really love her or her money? Which is...
To be honest, like, yeah. That's exactly it. That's exactly it. You've been such a good student today.
A plus.
No, that's exactly it. It's a strange dynamic. And, you know, it ends up being a good story with her going back to New York to see the Solomon Guggenheim Museum built. Oh. Which is the one that's there. And she's funny when she describes it. She's like, it looks like a parking garage.
Oh my God, it does.
And it's like, she's like, it looks like a parking garage, and it looks like it's in way too small of a space for it to be in. And she says, my uncle would be turning in his grave if he knew my paintings were in his fucking museum.
Ooh, yes.
But she meets one of her cousins, and he sends her this letter that, like, you know, is basically just like, you were right. All this shit that nobody gave you credit for. I'm sure it felt really good. And he said, you know, basically something to the effect of, like, it should be with the family. Like, we would love it to be with the family.
Yeah, I know you want
this
it.
Let's keep this collection with the family.
Now you fucking
And, you know, she, like, I think he just says it in a way that's like, you know, like, if you want it here, great. And we would,
we'll
you
take
know.
It. It,
we'll take care of it. And so she has, she did sell a majority of it to them, but there's a huge collection still remaining in her home, Palazzo Venier de Leoni, in Venice, that you can go to her house. And she actually had her house open when she was still alive, and the public could come in on certain days and look at the art, because she thought it was that important that they see these works and that they appreciate what was going on.
Yeah.
So you can still go today and see all of these works of art. And she's buried there with her 14 fucking dogs who she loves dearly. She used to, she had a gondola and like a gondola, you know, I don't know what you even call it, a gondolier.
Yeah, the
like,
gondola guy.
She would travel. In her older age, she's known as this woman that just like travels around via gondola.
Amazing.
With crazy fucking glasses on that somebody made for her in these crazy outfits. And she's just super fucking cool, but also kind of a bitch.
Yeah, yeah. Like all of us.
Like all of us. Yeah, she definitely has a like resting bitch face for sure. Sometimes her tongue sticks out and she doesn't even realize it.
You're rich.
Which
just
might
stick
be
your tongue out.
It might be it might be like a stimmy thing, you know, she's always like going like this.
Oh. Weird.
Yeah. Okay. So there's a quote, "For a patron is not simply a collector who gathers works of art for his own pleasure, or a philanthropist who helps artists or founds a public museum, but a person who feels responsibility towards both art and the artist together and has the means and will to act upon this feeling. So I think, like, in sum, you know, she is a patron.
Yeah.
And, yeah. So that's Googs,
that's
man.
Googs.
That's fucking Googs.
Ooh, that was a good
the
one.
Googs.
What a fucking slut. I love it.
I love it. with. Slutty oh makes slut slut. We love a slutty.
She fucks all these artists.
Yeah, you go. Yeah, I love dude. That. It's, yeah. So when thinking about like who to compare her to today, I had a hard time with this because obviously there's no heiress and there's nobody like her. But I think Lena Dunham is the perfect kind of closest one. She has, you know, more, she's a Nepo baby in a way because she's the daughter of two artists and she calls herself the voice of her generation. And she's a woman in the, like, who had pretty much gone where no woman had gone before, especially of her age with directing girls, which, I mean, for me, I fucking love that show. And whether you love her, whether you hate her, you can't deny her impact in the film industry. So... you go. You go, Hannah. Yeah, Lena, we love you. And she was also like a huge slut in that show, too. Oh, yeah.
And I liked a slut with like a body that we're not used to seeing on TV, but we're used to every day.
That's the other piece is like she's not your stereotypical, like idealized beauty, but she is beautiful in her own way.
Well, yeah, she's relatable of like, oh, yeah. Fucking normal bodies have sex too, and really hot
sex. She looks
sex.
Like a Botticelli painting. Yeah, totally.
I like it. Her tits are always out.
Her tits are always out. Tits. And I feel like if Peggy were alive today, her tits might always be out too. So here's to tits being out.
Let your tits
here's
out.
To those who tits out, tits up. Listen, Peggy, you were kind of a bitch. You were a horrible mom. But you are a badass bitch and a total Baroque bee. Yes. Thanks for everything you did. All right. So thanks for listening.
Thank you. I learned so much.
So, yeah. I love it. So next week, tune in.
It's going to be tune me in. Next time. Ooh.
And it's going to be. How should I dress?
Flowers. Flowers of some kind. Yeah.
Okay. That can mean so
you can do flowers. Think tropical. Think, I don't want to say the actual country, but we're going to another country.
Ooh. Yes. So okay. Think
flowers,
I like it. Let's
nature.
Go on vacation.
Yeah. Do nature.
And nature.
Yes. All right.
Let's go. Okay. All right, everybody. Listen.
We love you.
Bye.
Talking about my generation. Where's the budget?